the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. My name is Elise Elderkin. I'm a member here, and I would like to add my welcome to that of my predecessors, especially if you're a first-timer here. It is really cool to see you, and just come again. Now, I have to say, tonight's sermon is not going to be typical of a Belmont sermon. We are at the end of a three-part series on how to read, and 2 weeks ago, Derek did a How to Read a Movie. Last week, Hannah Richards did a How to Read a TV Show, and I'm doing How to Read a Book. And I don't know whether I came off easy or hard in that respect. I still haven't made up my mind. Sorry, I just need to get the doinker out. Each one has been different from the one before, which has been really interesting. Mine's going to be different from the other two, and which I think is rather wonderful. Anyway, okay. Now, in a couple minutes, by the way, I'm going to ask a question of the congregation at large. And I would be really grateful if somebody could wave their hand and give an answer, because it really is a question that I want answered. It isn't just, I'm not just talking to hear myself talk. Okay. So, this is not the question, by the way. Have you ever had the experience of reading a book and then going to see the movie, only to have it really disappoint and infuriate you? Well, have you thought about why that might be? Here's my thought. I know that I'm a visual learner, and that is that I take things in much better through my eyes than I do through my ears. You can imagine how great that is for sermons, can't you? But what that means is that when I'm reading a work of fiction, or sometimes even nonfiction, I sort of have a running scenario going on in my head. It's like creating a film of the book while you're reading it. And I imagine that a fair few of us probably do that. But if we've seen the mental movie, the actual Hollywood or Pinewood or Stockholm version kind of disappoints sometimes, doesn't it, or oftentimes. Well, I'm not going to stop running my scenarios, and I pass that on to you for what it's worth. Whilst reading a book, run a movie in its head, How to Read a Book, end of sermon, thank you very much, goodbye. If only. Okay, the brief for this sermon calls on me to use one particular book as a sort of set text, and I've chosen Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Now, Jane Austen was a clergyman's daughter who grew up in Hampshire. This is Steventon Rectory, now demolished, where she wrote the first version of Pride and Prejudice. She never married, and after her father's death, she lived for the rest of her life with her mother and sister, who was also unmarried, in Chawton, Hampshire, where she wrote the published version. And I've already had one member of the leadership team, who shall remain nameless, offer to reenact the lake scene from the BBC production of Pride and Prejudice by jumping into the baptistry wearing a frilly shirt. Woo! Here's what it looked like on television. Okay, now notice it says not in the book. Are there any thoughts? This is a question I'd like answered. Are there any thoughts on why this particular scene was added to the book in the television version? It's not a trick question. Really, no thoughts? Go for it, Dave. Could you say that louder and in English or American, maybe, so I could understand it? Yes, and so follow it up. See through white top? Bit of sex appeal, sure. I think so. Absolutely. Okay. Now, I've just been reading P.D. James's updated version of Pride and Prejudice, which is called Death Comes to Pemberley. And unlike some modern updates, which turn the novel into soft porn, P.D. James turns Jane Austen's novel into a thriller. And she, meanwhile, manages to maintain the style and a lot of the sensibility of the original. It's absolutely wonderful. And if anybody would like to borrow it, I would be happy to lend it to them as long as they return it afterwards. Whatever happened to my copy of Pride and Prejudice, which I lent to somebody sometime, I have no idea. But anyway, that's another story. I'm hoping the majority of you who haven't read Jane Austen's novels will have seen one of the many dramatizations of it. And for some of us, I think the young Colin Firth really is the epitome of Mr. Darcy. Okay, here's how the book begins. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Well, already, one can begin to see Jane Austen's sense of humor, her sharp eye for social customs, and her sense of what is right and what is proper, which aren't always the same thing. It's interesting that she begins the novel not with an event or a description, but with a principle, an umbrella under which the entire novel will shelter. Her tongue may be firmly in her cheek, but Jane Austen's novel will deal with marriage. Now, the structure of the plot basically entails two sisters of limited means marrying for love rather than for money, two young men who are extremely well off, one from trade. His father was a self-made man. That's a bit sort of not really respectable, but there we are. And the other from the inherited wealth of an old family. Along the way, Jane Austen mocks social pretentiousness of all sorts, both on the part of those trying to climb up the social ladder, but also those at the top who behave badly towards their social inferiors. The sisters themselves are also contrasted. The eldest, Jane, is gentle and non-judgmental, and she enjoys the good opinion of the entire village. Now, the second sister, Elizabeth, is clever and opinionated and doesn't suffer fools gladly. She's the apple of her father's eye, but many of the locals fear or scorn her because she's not really quite a proper young lady. The contemporary novelist, Jilly Cooper, who's probably not often quoted from this lecture, wrote in the Times a month ago, and she says this of novels generally: if you have a terrific plot and terrific characters, it really doesn't matter what they do, because you want to know what happens to them. You're biting your nails to discover whether they do get into bed, or they have a fight, or they fall in love. Well, leaving aside for the moment questions of morality, and we shall be returning to them, I think three points emerge here. Plot is key, characterization is important, and the writer's sense of humor is right up there. And we'll be looking at all these three in respect to Pride and Prejudice. We'll also be looking at how we as Christians respond to the story, its characters, and its observations of society in the time of the Napoleonic Wars and the Regency. So we're talking around late 1700s, very early 1800s. I've already mentioned the very basic outline of the plot. Of course, there are complications. This is, after all, a romance, as well as a social comedy. Jane Bennet and Mr. Bingley, one of the young couples, are attracted to each other, but he is both easily pleased and easily led, to the extent that his friend Darcy can detach him from Jane. Darcy's helped in this by Jane's cheerful, undemonstrative nature. As Charlotte Lucas points out, Bingley likes your sister undoubtedly, but he may never do more than like her if she does not help him on. Elizabeth Bennet, on the other hand, is entirely put off by Darcy's initial superciliousness. He's discovered to be proud, to be above his company, and above being pleased. Worse still, he refuses to dance with her at a ball early in the novel. His pride is answered by her prejudice. She reports his rejection with great spirit among her friends, for she had a lively, playful disposition, which delighted in anything ridiculous. Jane Austen describes Darcy as being haughty, reserved, and fastidious, and yet, very early in the novel, he begins to be attracted to Elizabeth, both by the beautiful expression in her dark eyes and her air of easy playfulness. However, both sisters are hardly socially fit matches for a wealthy gentleman, as they will inherit very little from their father. And furthermore, although their father is a gentleman, their mother is a woman of mean understanding, little information, and uncertain temper, When she was discontented, she fancied herself nervous. The business of her life was to get her daughters married, and its solace was visiting and news or gossip. It's just possible we know somebody like that. In any case, as a poor but garrulous listener, she is hardly considered an ornament to the polite society of Mr. Bingley or Mr. Darcy. In addition, the youngest sister, Lydia, at 15 chases after soldiers, and at 16 elopes with a young officer, a situation guaranteed to put her entire family under a social cloud forever. Mrs. Bennet's lack of both meaningful morality and awareness of social propriety in respect of Lydia's elopement is evident in Jane Austen's comment. She was more alive to the disgrace which a want of new clothes must reflect on her daughter's nuptials than to any sense of shame at her eloping and living with Wickham a fortnight before the nuptials took place. And here we see not only Jane Austen's acute ability to characterize with great economy, but also a more generalized human inability to apply Christian morality in places where it's inconvenient. Later on, Lydia shows only pride when entering her family home as a married woman for the first time. At dinner, she goes to the table and says, "Ah, Jane, I must take your place now, and you must go lower, because I am a married woman." When I read that, I just thought, the only thing I could think of was that Jesus parable of the banquet in Luke chapter 14. Okay, now you may be thinking, well, where does the Christian faith that I love figure in this novel? And I have to say, only by implication, rather than explicitly. In Pride and Prejudice, the church is represented by the Bennet girl's cousin, Mr. Collins, heir to the father's estate and an Anglican parson in Kent. Jane Austen describes him as a mixture of pride and obsequiousness, self-importance and humility. From his introduction, he is a figure to be mocked for his worldliness rather than for his faith. And it's interesting to remember that Jane Austen herself was a clergyman's daughter. He proposes to Elizabeth in a speech which all too clearly illustrates these qualities.
Easy circumstances, like myself, to set the example of matrimony in his parish. Secondly, that I am convinced that it will add very greatly to my happiness. And thirdly, which perhaps I ought to have mentioned earlier, that it is the particular advice and recommendation of the very noble lady whom I have the honour of calling patroness.
Elizabeth, of course, turns him down. But a later proposal is accepted by her friend, Charlotte Lucas, who reflects,
"Without thinking highly either of men or matrimony, marriage had always been her object. It was the only honourable provision for well-educated young women of small fortune, and however uncertain of giving happiness, must be their pleasantest preservative from want."
Well, if Elizabeth has a romantic view of marriage, this is the very opposite. Though, to be fair, at 27... Charlotte Lucas is on the very verge of being left on the shelf. Jane Austen, who never married, wrote the first version of Pride and Prejudice at 21, and it was published when she was 38. A stark contrast lies in Mr. Darcy's proposal to Elizabeth further on in the novel. Beginning with the romantic, "You must allow me to tell you how ardently I love you." He then continues in the authorial voice. Jane Austen comments that,
"He was not more eloquent on the subject of tenderness than of pride. His sense of her social inferiority, of it being a degradation of the family obstacles which judgment had always opposed to inclination, were dwelt on with a warmth which seemed due to the consequence he was wounding, but was very unlikely to recommend his suit."
And so Elizabeth turns down her second marriage proposal of the novel. The novel's turning point comes about two-thirds of the way through, when, during a visit to Darcy's estate at Pemberley, from which he is meant to be absent, Elizabeth learns from his housekeeper that he is the best landlord and the best master that ever lived. Then, when she unexpectedly bumps into him, she finds him much changed.
And his behaviour, so strikingly altered. What could it mean? That he should even speak to her was amazing. But to speak with such civility to inquire after her family. Never in her life had she seen his manners so little dignified. Never had he spoken with such gentleness as on this unexpected meeting.
Oh, gosh, isn't that the stuff that romances are made of? Oh, and it is the moment when, despite Elizabeth's lack of awareness, her prejudice is overcome by his lack of pride. The meeting is neatly followed by news of Lydia's elopement with Wickham, an event which gives Darcy the opportunity to demonstrate his love by being of service, finding the couple, and paying for their marriage. The point here, surely, is that manners maketh man or woman. What is required is softness of heart, not social position. Indeed, the whole novel is a comprehensive examination of what makes a good or a bad marriage. In addition to the growing relationships between Jane and Bingley and Elizabeth and Darcy, there are darker or less attractive marriages as well. For example, when Charlotte Lucas marries Mr. Collins, she makes sure that the arrangements at the rectory give her a room entirely for herself, while he gets much pleasure from going out and working in the garden or gazing out the front window in a completely different room. Again, Jane Austen has this to say of Wickham and Lydia when they have been some months married. His affection for her soon sunk into indifference. Hers lasted a little longer, and in spite of her youth and her manners, she retained all the claims to reputation which her marriage had given her. Goodness me, you can hardly get your tongue out of your cheek by saying that, can you? In this respect, though, their marriage mirrors that of the Bennet parents. Had Elizabeth's opinion been all drawn from her own family, she would not have formed a very pleasing picture of conjugal felicity or domestic comfort. Her father, captivated by youth and beauty, and that appearance of good humour which youth and beauty generally have, had married a woman whose weak understanding and illiberal mind had very early in their marriage put an end to all real affection for her. Respect, esteem, and confidence had vanished forever, and all his views of domestic happiness were overthrown. Respect, esteem, and confidence are what we see between Darcy and Elizabeth and between Jane and Bingley, but not in the other couples. And whether or not we are married, are they not the qualities that we long to see in our relationships with those whom we care for? Do we not want the barriers of pride and prejudice to be torn down, not only in our own relationships, but between groups of people, between families, between countries? Surely these are the longings not just of women, but of right-thinking human beings everywhere. Okay, it's time to stop here and look at what Scripture says about pride. So if you want to grab the Bibles from in front of you and turn to page 1114. There are many references to pride, mostly in the Old Testament. Typical is Psalm 101, where David says that whoever has haughty eyes and a proud heart, I will not endure. Jesus doesn't make any mention of pride other than his reference to arrogance in the list of things that come out of a person and defile him in Mark chapter 7. But he spends much time in specifying the sins that pride produces, such as negligence towards the alienated or the unfortunate, or presumptuousness towards God. This morning, Derek alluded to the story of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke chapter 16. Or we could think of the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector in the temple in Luke 18. But I want to turn to Paul in Philippians chapter 2 on page 1114. He's the greatest of Jesus' apologists in his extended definition of humility, which precedes his hymn on the humility of Christ, is this. Therefore, if you have any encouragement in being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in the Spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. This passage challenges both literature and behavior, ancient and modern. Humility isn't really all that popular a topic. In regard to selfish ambition or vain conceit, one need look no further than Mrs. Bennett or Lady Catherine de Bourgh. In regard to tenderness and compassion, we can just look at Jane. Darcy and Elizabeth are clearly more complicated, multi-sided characters, and both of them have to learn to look more broadly towards the interests of others. But this transformation, in fact, as they change towards that, is one of the things that makes the book such a joy to read. The values of Pride and Prejudice are typically English, can I say that? Maybe one should say Anglican, I don't know. It's worth repeating that Elizabeth's heart is turned towards Darcy, both by the physical beauties of Pemberley as a place and by his reputation as a wise and charitable master of his estate. Her heart then begins to be filled with gratitude, not merely for once having loved her, but for loving her still well enough to forgive all the petulance and acrimony of her manner in rejecting him. Darcy's heart is softened by love. Elizabeth thinks that never had she seen him so desirous to please, so free from self-consequence or unbending reserve as now. And he also uses his fortune wisely in buying Lydia and by extension her entire family out of the infamy that an elopement would have produced. He looks to the interests of others, if they also happen to be his own interests, because Elizabeth's heart is won by his generosity. Well, hey, this is a romance. And here I depart from the principles of Jilly Cooper, or rather add to them, because I believe that we ourselves are won over by the moral certainties of Jane Austen's society and the way she describes her characters. We have no doubt which characters are morally weak. Remember her description of Mrs. Bennet. Or take, for example, the introduction to the novel of Lady Catherine de Bourgh. Her air was not conciliating, nor was her manner of receiving them such as to make her visitors forget their inferior rank. Whatever she said was spoken in so authoritative a tone as marked her self-importance. Though high in social rank, Lady Catherine, in both description and behavior, is full of pride and wholly inattentive to the interests of others. She has no softness of heart. Well, nowadays, we don't live in a society where everyone knows his or her place. Society isn't so hierarchically structured as it was 200 years ago. But we still know when we watch somebody for a while, don't we? Whether or not they're genuinely interested in the feelings and welfare of other people. And we like people who have a good heart, and we feel uncomfortable with those who don't, Christians or not. The contemporary writer Jeanette Winterson grew up in a house with a manic depressive mother who allowed no books save the Bible and two commentaries. Although she did make Jeanette go to the library every week to get her a big collection of thrillers. In her autobiography, Why Be Happy When You Can Be Normal, she writes this: books don't make a home, they are one, in the sense that just as you do with a door, you open a book and you go inside. I don't know whether you've noticed, but if you ever read the bestseller lists in the papers, they've been topped for many months by a trilogy of books from a category which is known these days as mummy porn. And they've sold millions, millions and millions, literally. A reviewer in the American weekly Time magazine recently had this to say about mummy porn: where else are women's longings examined with as much fervor, acceptance, and compassion? Well, in answer to that question, I would say, you know, in view of what we've seen this evening, a good place to start might be Pride and Prejudice. Jane Austen's novels are a very good place to start. They at least do not reduce women to the sum total of their sexual fantasies. Books are indeed a home, and one whose furnishings we should pay close attention to as we enter. Too many homes these days are jerry-built and furnished on the cheap and nasty. Books have so much more to offer than the purported fulfillment of one's physical desires. As Michaelmore Pergo, author of War Horse, recently wrote, "Telling stories is about connection. My readers are strangers until they read my books. We connect through the story to one another and to other readers too. Writer and reader have shared the same dream." When we really, really engage with a good book, we undergo communion. We spend time in its world, with its people, and one hopes that we are or should be the better for doing that. Is it too presumptuous to say that this could be true either of Pride and Prejudice or St. Luke's Gospel? In the opening ceremony to the Paralympics, Ian McKellen's Prospero said, "Books are humanity in print." And I'd like to finish with this question. What do today's books reveal about today's humanity? And what does our own reading reveal about us?